You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, July 2nd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, down the up escalator, how the 99% live in the Great Recession, with Barbara Garson. Be joining us on the program today. Also on the program, Edward Snowden seeking asylum, stuck in, presumably, in a transit area of a Moscow airport. Meanwhile, the war on women continues, or perhaps more specifically, to be fair, the war on women who want to be treated as equal citizens in our society. The war on women's rights continues. And congratulations, if you are taking out a student loan for any education starting today. Your Stafford subsidized rates have doubled because of the inaction of Congress. So the U.S. government will be making twice as much money off of you for getting an education. Congrats. Meanwhile, we giveth with one hand and taketh away with the other. If you happen to be a former general who was formerly head of the CIA and then had to leave because you had an affair and God knows why else, you just may be eligible for an incredibly high-paying job with a CUNY-related school. And in Egypt, 17 to 30 million people of Egypt's 85 million person population have been protesting. Morsi has now 24, maybe 21 hours of a from a military ultimatum calling on him to step down. There are protesters out in the streets now. We will talk about that. Drone strikes, apparently, in a new study, found to be more dangerous to civilians than manned aerial bombing. You can chalk that, or I guess that puts to lie the argument that somehow drone strikes are more targeted, at least in Afghanistan. Also, a follow-up, about a week ago or so, we were talking about a story involving GMO crops. And I was talking about what I saw as the primary danger of GMO crops being their impact on ecosystems and in our environment. And I think I said something to the effect, I don't know if I went this far. I mean, putting aside the notion of potential health implications of GMO crops, which I had suggested were at least unsubstantiated. A couple of readers sent me in stuff that substantiates their potential health impacts, at least to some degree, as if there wasn't enough reason with just the ecological implications of GMO crops. But we will talk about that. And that and more. Also, we have, well, I mean, this is probably something that's obvious to everyone, but of course, the real growing problem of lesbians on cooking shows, making it virtually impossible to watch them for a number of Americans. Yes, we will get to that as the show continues. We will also get to Barbara Gerson and the interview I did with her last week. It was towards the end of last week, I guess, a pre-taped interview on her book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession, which is a, it's an interesting book insofar as many of the dynamics we have certainly covered ad nauseum on this program as to what has happened over the past 30 years and that have left the middle class so vulnerable, particularly in the particularly to a an economic disruption like we had in 2008 and continues to this day. But Barbara Gerson went out and spoke to these people, has profiles of different people's situations, very interesting perspective on it. I want to talk a little bit about what's going on, not only in Texas, but also in Ohio. But first, let's start with what's going on in Texas. As you know, last week, there was an incredibly dramatic moment. And it was really, in many respects, a 12-hour moment in the Texas Senate, which was holding a special session to force through anti-choice amendments, basically robbing women of their sovereignty of their, over their own body. Under Texas legislative rules, a special session requires only a half majority, as opposed to two-thirds majority, to pass certain legislation, which is why they're doing this in a special session. It's basically an end run around democracy in many respects. Presently in Texas, the and you will recall last week, because of a filibuster by Wendy Davis that was aided by her Democratic colleagues in the last hour, and then in the last 15 minutes by thousands of protesters in the Texas state legislature. These laws, which would have effectively eliminated access to abortion care for a massive amounts of women in Texas, eliminating the number of providers from something like from 45 down to about 5 in an incredibly large state, one that also has a 24-hour waiting period, so would have effectively made for many Texas women a three-day process that would have increased the cost of it. I think Amanda Marcotte did a great breakdown of this, to somewhere around the equivalent of a 2 weeks worth of wages for your average American. They have gone back into special session. Before this bill, which was SB 5, I don't know if it still remains SB 5, makes it back to the Senate, it first must go through the Texas House. It will pass there, however, not before there is public comment. To fast-track this process, the Texas House has put a cap, a temporal cap, on comments from the public to midnight tonight. The hearing will start, I believe, any moment now, And we will hear about 12 hours worth of comments before it is shut down. And then it will head to the Senate. I imagine there's only so many times that Democrats and foes of what are arguably unconstitutional restrictions on abortion in the state of Texas can stop this law from passing, but we will see. Meanwhile, in Ohio yesterday, John Kasich, Republican governor, former Fox News host, former right-wing nut job congressman, will sign a budget bill. What does the budget bill have to do with a woman's right to choose an abortion? Well, in the last hours of debates regarding the budget, anti-choice provisions were added by amendment with no hearing, no debate, no comment period, no chance for lawmakers to consider the impact of this legislation, buried within the budget bill so that there could be as little public discussion as possible. That, I think on that accord, it probably failed insofar as there was a lot of protests about this in Ohio. But the effects of the Ohio legislation, which of course was just a budget, is that rape crisis centers will now operate under a state-imposed gag order. If you are a rape counselor and you are dealing with a victim of rape, you cannot tell an impregnated rape victim that they can legally terminate their pregnancy. Additionally, if you are in Ohio, you will find that Ohio has now basically defunded all Planned Parenthood clinics across the state. You are also forced, if you are seeking an abortion, to undergo a state-mandated, completely medically unnecessary ultrasound. Even if the woman patient does not want one, and even if the doctor doesn't recommend one, the state is forcing you now to get a completely unnecessary ultrasound. Women will also have to pay for that completely unnecessary state-mandated ultrasounds. Doctors will now also be required to deliver a Republican-written speech to women seeking legal abortions, whether or not the doctor believes that anything in this speech is valid, necessary, or accurate. And in a wonderful two-step, the bill requires clinics that provide abortion services to have a transfer agreement with local hospitals. In many instances, there are no hospitals locally available. However, that is irrelevant because the bill also bans public hospitals from establishing those agreements. And finally, the words pregnancy and fetus have now been redefined in Ohio state law, making the determination that a woman is pregnant even before the fertilized egg is implanted in the uterine lining, which could very well mean that IUD devices are illegal in Ohio. And just in case you were wondering, Kasich has a line item veto authority, which many state governors can have. We don't have that on the federal level. It's found unconstitutional. Where he could have vetoed those specific provisions in the budget, and he chose not to. There's a wonderful photo where he is surrounded by five or six old white guys cheering him on, presumably, to strip women of their constitutional right for access to abortion. So that's Ohio for you. It remains to be seen what the fallout from that will be, but hopefully people in Ohio are aware that it has taken place. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll play this interview that I did the other day with Barbara Garson. Following that, we will talk about Egypt, Snowden's travails, George Bush's claims that everything he did that has now been found to have trampled on our civil liberties, even as deemed by his own lawyers in his administration, was done to protect civil liberties. Yes, if that makes no sense, understand I'm relating what George Bush said. Also, we will talk more about Egypt, student loan rates, all that and more. But first, let's take a break and we'll go to Barbara Garson. We are back on the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Barbara Garson. She is the author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Welcome to the program, Barbara.
Thank you.
So, Barbara, give me a sense. I mean, I think this our audience is pretty familiar with the structural reasons that we see such stagnation and whatnot across the country in terms of wages and in terms of who was hit in the wake of this financial crisis. One of the things about your story is that you really dig into the stories of individuals, and you organize these folks in terms of their loss of job, home, and savings. What did you find? I mean, was there a common theme that
you... Yes, there was. I mean, I kind of, like you said, there was a structural problem. Everybody has written a lot about the banks and the particular scheme of securitizing housing loans at the end. But in fact, what I found is that everybody involved, in order to live just an ordinary life that they thought was a middle-class life, had been borrowing. Some of them were house loans, and people lost their houses, mortgage loans, but others were college loans that they were encouraged to take. And so as I began to talk to people, I realized that they or their parents had been economically stagnating or actually losing wages and losing wealth for about 40 years. And the banks, as they didn't get paid enough money to buy what they produced, so to speak, banks lent them the money. It's as if they said to them, oh, instead of paying you to buy what you produce, we'll lend you the money. Obviously, that's a short-range strategy. I mean, if a man doesn't have $10 this month, this year, how is he going to have $15 next year to pay you back with interest if his wages aren't going up or if his salary isn't going up? And that short-range thing was kind of desperation on the bank's part. I mean, wages weren't going up. Productivity was increasing greatly. So it were ordinary people that I met who did what they should have done, who they were encouraged to do, buy a starter house, and then you're going to sell that for more and move to another house, take out loans for college. They were stuck. And it really all came not so much from their desperate need to borrow, but from the bank's desperate need to lend, because companies weren't borrowing in normal ways to produce more, because, you know, it was that vicious circle that came from, that started with the great idea that came up starting in the 1970s and reached its peak in the Reagan administration. We'll just squeeze the profits out of ordinary people.
Now, give me a sense. I mean, I want to circle back to that and sort of the level of awareness that people had in terms of seeing their predicaments in a broader context. But before we get there, give me a sense of the types of people that you interviewed. I mean, you set out, I think it was in 2009, right? And so you were really on the road for quite a while.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand. On the road to...
On the road in terms of talking to many people who...
Oh, yes. I did talk to a lot of people around the country. You know, when you lose your house, you might think that the broker gave you a bum steer. But in the absence of a political movement, it's not likely that you're going to think what I just said about the about your being the victim of 40 years of an economic downturn. You just think you're angry at a particular broker, if that's your inclination. Or worse of all, many people are just upset about themselves. I was a sucker. I was a loser. You know, a man who's worked 35 years for the same big box company in Evansville, Indiana, is saying, you know, some people, they sell a house, they make money, but not us. So he was in a position where he couldn't sell his house to move to a farm where he intended to retire. In the meantime, his company is kind of forcing him out of work. He's worked for them for 40 years. His favorite thing, 35 years. His favorite thing is refereeing soccer, which he does now even though his children are too old to play themselves. And suddenly the company is giving him night shifts, 12-hour shifts, 10-hour shifts. Of course, he's a manager, so he has no extra time. And he believes, remembering back to the 50s and television programs primarily, that a manager should be able to take his family on vacation, put the kids through college, buy a car every few years. And he can't do any of that. And I think that in his own mind, yes, he believes certain individuals have been unfair to him, but basically he feels like he just couldn't cut the mustard. It's a very unfortunate feeling. And in the absence of a program like yours or some kind of movement that maybe explained to him what happened, he will go on feeling that way. It's a funny feeling, funny family, because this was part of a family where he just wanted his son to do better. And the kid was sort of a hippie, because the kid looked at the father's situation and said, I'm not going to work like that for anybody.
Right.
And the father would say, if only he would cut his hair, he could buckle down and get a good job. And he was very smart. He kept saying, oh, he's so smart, which he was. And so, but I'd ask him what his friends could do. And the only jobs he could think of in Evansville for his friends, he'd say, well, if they put on the hairnet at McDonald's, they're smart. They'll work their way up to manager. My company hires McDonald's managers sometimes because they have a lot of discipline, and they could then soon have the position he has, the position in which he knows they're trying to force him out, take away his pension. I mean, it's very sad, but certainly he thinks of himself as to blame.
That's fascinating. And I mean, are there other do you have other examples of the people that you spoke to that have a similar perspective in terms of blaming, seeing the problems in many respects, it's seeing their economic problems as isolated and as unique in some respect.
Well, everybody does. Well, no, I take it back. A lot of people had the comfort of at least saying this is a recession when they at first couldn't find jobs. Like I interviewed four people living here in New York who discovered through their church that they were all unemployed. So they formed a pink slip club. And they thought that for the 2 or 3 weeks that they were out of work, why not enjoy the city? That's what they paid those high rents to do. And they would go to concerts during the day and tell each other about free movie screenings they could get into. And then the weeks turned into months. Now, in some regard, they had the comfort of knowing it was a recession. All of them remembered the jobs they got 20 years earlier that they got, you know, just by asking around a little bit. And they thought that would happen again. And they knew it was a recession, but still, that does not save you from the pain they were feeling as they sent in applications. These are all professionals. Well, you know, sort of middle-range professionals, an insurance adjuster, a person who did graphics, meaning the not the pictures, but the layout for textbooks. These people were sort of professionals, and yes, they knew it was a recession, but believe me, they felt pretty awful sending in hundreds and eventually thousands of resumes, always online, always to people that didn't respond, even the courtesy of saying the position has already been filled. They felt pretty bad. I mean, even though they had the comfort of knowing this is a recession, this isn't us, I wasn't fired for cause, nobody said you are fired, but rather we are cutting back. Another thing that shows you how the country is changing is that not only won't these individuals, if they get a job, the job itself will have changed. In other words, while these people were unemployed, the jobs they previously had were converted by the companies for the most part, and I have a lot of good examples where I follow the company and I follow the person, were converted into part-time, contingent, you become a consultant, an entrepreneur. And so that graphics person, if he gets another job, will never get the same salary and will never really get the same job, and neither will anybody else. So that's why it's not really a temporary recession. It's a big downhill thing that it's funny. It's a ruling class in this country that seems to think the country is finished and this is the way we have to go and there's no moving back up and they'll just sell to people abroad. So it's really a very sad picture, although some of the people were very clever.
Well, what is the emotional arc of those people? I mean, I get the idea that the sense sometimes of isolation, and I also get the notion of that isolation being mitigated by this sense that the nation is in a recession. But what happens after they realize that they're not going to get another job, that this recession is not resolving itself in the same way that maybe past recessions have?
Well, I got to know one of the people very well, the insurance adjuster. She was such an efficient person. When I said, she told me about the day she was fired. Everybody tells you about the day they were fired, and they have usually some way of telling the story in which they personally show a little dignity, like they finished their work or they helped a colleague. This person said, I was like jelly. I couldn't move. I don't know how I walked through the day. And then she told me about a friend who invited her out to dinner, said that she always did that. Someone did it for her once, and she always did it for people who were fired. So I said, I'd like to talk to your friend. Now, this was about 2 weeks after she was fired, And she immediately made a phone call, set us up very, very, very efficiently while we were talking, like encouraging me to make the date and get it straight, and I did. And she was that kind of person. Well, by a year and a half later, she was a much more lethargic person. You wouldn't think to hire her for the same job, because remember, insurance adjusting involved calling people, taking a lot of initiative, calling people up on the telephone, finding the real story, getting them to settle. She was, in that regard, a different person. I mean, she'd taken in a roommate. She'd done one thing after another. She'd gone through her 401k or whatever her non-retirement plan was. And that's another example. When she first started working, she had a real retirement system, but that was dissolved by the company and changed into these new things. So, yeah, of course it's a downhill move. I also have one terrific guy who I never thought would find a job, who found the almost identical job, and it was just amazing when he did. It was amazing transformation. I mean, it's like a miracle. You don't believe when you see a person that's let down. It's hard for you to imagine that they'll spring back and be the other person, or that they ever were the other person. I mean, look, my husband had it wasn't a recession thing. Rupert Murdoch fired all the people at the New York Post, and he was a photographer. And you wouldn't think that you'd feel bad about being fired by Rupert Murdoch. You wouldn't want to be the person he kept. But still, and he wasn't going to starve to death. I mean, it was always me, the writer. And yet, he was in the hospital two times thinking he was having a heart attack. His heart was beating so fast. You can't talk yourself out of that personal response, even though you know everybody's in the situation, unless there's something that's absent right now, a real movement that says, hey, let's do something. Let's raise wages. Let's have a student debt strike. You know, unless you have that, I don't think you can feel.
I'm curious, did you come across people who, as they became more...
And even if you have that, you might not feel...
Right.
You might still suspect you're the one.
Well, yeah, I'm curious. I mean, did you come across any examples of people who, as they became, as their job search wore on, as they became more discouraged, were there any that whose perspective shifted from blaming themselves or seeing themselves as uniquely unfortunate? Were there any that in some way became radicalized or began to perceive themselves within the context or as a victim of something far greater than themselves, far greater than their own personal decisions, but rather something structural?
I did meet one person down at Liberty Square, you know, at Occupy.
Right.
And that was the beginning of that. Was someone who was overwhelmed by his student debts. Again, something he was encouraged to take, and he began to realize, hey, an 8.5% debt when the government is giving away money for free, and that debt is one that the bank can't possibly lose on because the government will cover it if I stop paying. So he began to get involved in the debt movement, and I think that made him feel a little less like a personal sucker who took out a debt that he would repay through a job that didn't exist. I mean, some of the people I met, I talked to extreme people. I mean, extreme in their suffering. Someone, I had dinner with someone who didn't know where she was going to live the next day because I'd met her in court, and she said, "Gee, I think the sheriff told you stuff for 10 days, doesn't he? She has 4 floors of furniture." So of course she was extremely down and out, and that was an extreme case. But I also met people who were very normal, who did what they were supposed to do. And there was one little chapter I called Bubble Birth Control, because this perfectly model young man and his wife who had borrowed money to go to school, hadn't lost their jobs. They were private high school teachers, but they wanted to move to a place where they were both able to get very secure jobs in the same city of Minneapolis. And when they went, and they had one child, and when they went to sell their house, they discovered that if they sold it at the current prices, they would still owe the bank $200,000.
They were, it's so a classic case
decide,
of being underwater.
Do I move under those circumstances? And they did. If the lawyer they left behind couldn't arrange a short sale, which is very difficult to arrange, they would ruin their credit rating. But they did move, and I left them in suspense. But these people did every normal thing that they were supposed to do. So I think understood that the circumstances went against them.
I'm curious about that their example, because you write about
they're so normal. I mean, a woman wrote me. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Well, I mean, because the idea about it. I mean, this is one of the things that I think sort of the Occupy movement was built upon, and for some reason, at one point, hit a stasis. Now, part of that is because you had a massive police force that was shutting them down in many respects.
Let's face it, part of it is because however much fun it is to have an elitist movement, we did the same thing in Berkeley, doesn't leave a lot behind, but okay.
But this impetus where you have this couple that basically say, we're going to walk, we're going to mail in the keys to this house, we're going to walk away from this, that they are... they become untethered from this notion that somehow their debt is a moral debt, whereas
if I'm
a company and I default on, with my creditors, I go into Chapter 11, I reorganize, that's business. That's not
right. –
there's no morality involved in that. I've never seen –
how would that happen? If you want to talk of that as a radicalization, I did certainly watch that happen. People to tell you the truth, the only people left feeling it was a debt that I'd interviewed were church ladies, black church ladies, who still had to go bankrupt, but who felt terrible about that debt. I was so surprised at the people who walked away from those debts. I met a man who paid for a year and a half while he tried to negotiate a modification under these crazy Obama rules.
Under HAMP, under the Home Affordable Modification Plan.
Right, which was it was a completely voluntary program. The only thing the banks were required to do was to accept your application.
And we should say there has been extraordinary
evidence
just this past month from about a half dozen whistleblowers from the Bank of America, and there's no reason to believe that other banks were involved in this, that the banks were actually giving bonuses to their employees for not telling people what modification they're available for and driving them into foreclosure. I mean, this was a systemic plan by the banks after the fact, and this has just came out, I think, in the past month or so, that at the very least, Bank of America.
God. I talked to people. A man took this huge pile of negotiations. He was very good at this. This was his former job. He was a bureaucrat, and he had this huge stack of papers he put down in front of me with the bank requesting the same information over and over. All this time, him paying his mortgage, even though he's unemployed, he's borrowing from his mother-in-law, et cetera. He just felt that was an obligation. And he said to me, do you think they are just confused asking for the same information over and over, or you think they're just stalling? And it was very hard to tell. And this man went through about a year and a half, and when he finally found a new job and they refused his modification, that's when he stopped paying on his house. I was so amazed, because he was such a moral man. And he the last time I spoke to him, he was in the house, and he called the bank and he said, well, come and get it if you want it. And I was so amazed by that personal transformation in him. It still leaves him very insecure, but it leaves him mentally in a position where he can decide when to move, and I think he will, and he'll run away from the house.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, that dynamic is fascinating to me. And, of course, you know, like I say, I have listeners of this program who went through a very similar thing, that the HAMP program was, in many respects for them, simply a completely fraudulent. And now we have, you know, evidence that, in fact, it was fraudulent, you know, in its.
Well, I'm going to have to get that for you after the on the air, because down the up escalator, he and I sit there. He keeps asking me over and over, could this be real? Do you think they just don't understand? You know, they constantly change negotiators with him, and each negotiator. And they would have programs called the HOPE program. He said, I think it has something to do with Obama. I'm promoted to the HOPE program, which only means that they lost all my papers again. You know, and they were just stalling, he felt, as long as he would go on paying. HOPE meant they would give him some false hope as long as he could go on paying. So I will be happy to show that to him.
Oh, yes. David Dayan is reported on this in Salon. I think it was probably maybe 10, 15 days ago, so middle of June.
I shall go look at David who?
David Dayan.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a bad connection. So
well,
I will.
I'll give you that after the interview. But, I mean, okay. So, you know, I mean, it is, it's so, I mean, ultimately, what – to the extent that when you step back and you take a look at what you reported on, what you saw, to what is the broader sense that you get? I mean, in other words, can you get a sense of a broader change in the way that the people, at the very least, that you spoke to viewed their place in society in a sort of in a political way, as opposed to, I mean, this is what sort of fascinates me, is that what are the circumstances that allow for someone to see this as their individual plight? What are those things that radicalize in the sense that I'm not going to perceive my debt in the way that the banks want me to perceive that debt?
And people may become cynical. But in the absence of a movement, in the absence, you know, a few people who are talking about socialism say, hey, you know, people are ready to listen. But without talking about it, I don't think people automatically get the idea that
I mean, I wonder what is missing here from this equation? Because it's almost as if there's, you know,
In the 30s, there was a large communist and socialist movement, and they didn't win the day, so to speak, for their movements, but they certainly scared the capitalists into taking some stand. I can't believe that they're just going on now saying, ho-hum, as long as we put the next bank crisis off for a while, we're okay. Need to do what you're doing to get enough consciousness out there that we can say to somebody, let's nationalize the banks. Let's make our banks used for our purposes. I mean, it's people will only begin to think about that sort of thing. I mean, you don't think about it spontaneously, I don't think. You only feel maybe more cynical spontaneously. Spontaneously, people began to not pay their debts. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not sure, but that happened spontaneously.
And I mean, but I guess,
don't think they formed debtors' movements that said, forgive these debts,
right?
Spontaneously.
I mean,
but that would be a great thing. When student loans first started, I mean, these high-interest student loans, I really thought in my mind, I mean, I'm talking 30 years ago, I said, that's going to be the next great bonus march. People are going to be marching for forgiveness of student debts, because if there aren't jobs, I mean, student debts are a pyramid scheme.
I mean, it's fascinating.
But
because
it didn't happen. I'm amazed that it hasn't happened yet. I think it's the most productive of the items that have remained from Occupy is their debt. Are there debt committees? But I don't know whether they is being me, we. I don't know whether we, me, will be able to put the work in to make it really a full-fledged movement.
Well,
that's when you'll feel not so bad about having a stupid student debt.
Well, Barbara Garson, Hope Springs Eternal, the book is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're back. And we are going to head into the thing that we tend to call the better half of the program, but it really is just the second half of the program. It functions in two purposes. One, it allows me to cover more stories, like the doubling of student loan rates, like the woeful tale of a poor, forlorn former general who's now going to teach, what, like 3 hours a week? 3 hours.
3 hours a week.
What does that break down to? $150,000 a year, I guess it was. I can't even do that type of math, folks. When the integer... we'll also talk about the situation that's going on in Egypt. The story of drone strikes creating more civilian casualties than manned aerial strikes. We'll get to that GMO story I had mentioned earlier. Folks, the second half of the program also serves as a bonus for you if you find it in your heart or pocketbook or wallet or digital wallet to support the first half of the program. That's the way I'm now contextualizing it. You can keep the first half of the program going in well into the future. And as a bonus, as a thank you, we also say, here's more content if you want. By becoming a member today at majority.fm, very easy to sign up. Very easy if you have, a lot of people have been asking me lately, how do I get the member show on my iPhone? If you have an iPhone, it's very easy to sign up on the podcast app. If you have an Android phone, there are apps where you can simply put in your RSS feed in there. Very easy to get it there. And eventually, someday, I imagine, when Saul is the host of this program, we will have our own app. That, but I'm not going to get into that saga. So, become a member today. You can sign up at majority.fm. You can also support this program by going to majority.fm, clicking on our Amazon link down at the bottom of the homepage, bookmarking it, buying all your Amazon junk through that. We get a kickback. It's much appreciated. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. 10% coupon code majority. Sign up for, if you watch stuff on YouTube, sign up for, subscribe. Give us some good review on iTunes. If you like the program, there's no reason why we shouldn't literally have tens of thousands of reviews. Because if you listen to the program on a regular basis, it's the least you can do. Go over to iTunes and just give it a good review. That helps. We are more often than not, if you go to the politics section of iTunes, you will see that we are more often than not in the what's hot section. And think about that for a moment. It's not even a visual podcast. Still, we're in the what's hot. Just, I guess, by the sounds of our voices. I'm not sure how they vote on that or who the people are at iTunes. That. And coming up in the better half, of course, the the terrible tragedy of watching a cooking show and having lesbian come on? And what will you tell the children? What will you tell the children when they find out that apparently lesbians also cook? So stick around for that. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 if you want to call the program. You can IM me at Majority FM or any of our legacy IMs. If you're a libertarian and itching to call up the program.
It's been a while.
You should call in. A little housekeeping. On July 4th, there will only be a members show. And then on July 5th, there'll be a pretty full show. It will consist of pre-recorded interviews, but none that you have heard in their entirety. Let's put it that way. All right, folks. See you in the better half.